Welcome, Keith Runyon, the General Secretary of Quaker Earthcare Witness. We're so excited to have you on the Emerge podcast. I'm so excited that Lee Hall, my friend and colleague from Radnor Meeting and one of the fearless leaders of Radnor Meeting's Climate Action Committee, I'm so glad, Lee, that you can be here too for this conversation. We've been thinking and talking about this for a long time, so this is like a dream come true to be able to have a few minutes to talk with you, Keith, and to share that with our community and with other Quakers, you know, in the region that we're connecting with. And I want to say that Lee is really spearheading a whole movement of Quakers down here around climate action stuff. I think you know that. So we're going to make the most of this time together. For listeners who may be joining us for the first time, we call this the Emerge podcast because it ties into our work on Emerge values. I hope we're going to get in a little bit to Quaker Earthcare Witness. It's your view of the values element of this, which we think is so important. I know that QEW has worked a lot with the Quaker spices, and we're innovating off spices into this new articulation, which is around empathy, mindfulness, ecological integrity, resilience, growth, and endurance, which we call Emerge. And particularly what gathers us here tonight is the focus on resilience. We feel the challenge of this moment, we feel the rollback of this moment on things that really matter deeply to us. And so it's an opportunity for us to be together to talk about what keeps us strong, spiritually focused at such a difficult time. And of course, part of that is the friendships and relationships that we have with each other. But I want to open the floor to you, Keith, and just give you a chance to talk a little bit with listeners who may be unfamiliar with the work of Quaker Earthcare Witness. And I want to tell everybody you can find out more, of course, by going to the website, which is quakerearthcare.org. So go there definitely. But tell us a little bit of the origin story of Quaker Earthcare Witness. Mm-hmm. I think it's something really wonderful to think about and remember. And I'd love to just hear your view of that.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's great to be here with both of you, David and Lee, and with all of our listeners. And I think to jump into the storyline here, you zoom back to 1987, 1985, actually, maybe, Intermountain Yearly Meeting with a wonderful keynote address by, and as of at that time, I think lesser known Quaker, Marshall Massey of, well, he's from Montana now. I'm not actually sure if that's where he was at the time, but Marshall came in with a really powerful speech, basically making the argument that earth care and peace and all Quaker values, that we could not understand basically Quaker values without putting earth care at the heart of them. And he made the point also very clearly, not just in the climate crisis, but, you know, went through the full biogeochemical flows of the planet and basically said, everything that keeps life alive on this earth is being disrupted by human activities. And it is up to Quakers, up to friends to not only address that, you know, growing problem in the world, but further to sink back into our own faith tradition, the peaceable kingdom. That was the phrase that is used in his pamphlet at the time. And this, I read that a few years ago as I was getting started at Quaker Earthcare Witness, but it's a powerfully written piece, just kind of an ode to the beauty of the earth, to the need for a spiritual response. And he's a conservative friend. He is not, you know, of the sort of Friends General Conference, liberal friends tradition. And I had the joy of meeting him just 2 years ago on a surprise visit as Nora and I started traveling the country as part of our traveling ministry. Anyways, it was really his, I think there was a growing movement among friends. Generally, I don't want to put all on this one individual. In fact, he himself stepped back from the leadership of Quaker Earthcare Witness to really make sure it wasn't a just charisma-driven movement at the beginning. But in 1987, Friends General Conference, the final seed was planted. And there was Marshall Massey led a workshop that whole week. And at the end of the workshop, they decided to start an organization that was Friends Committee on Unity with Nature. And the sole purpose that they saw in that was the unification of this spiritual calling back to the earth with the rest of what it meant to be a Quaker. And so they were testifying and going to all these Quaker meetings saying, if you don't have earth care at the heart of what you're doing, you've missed, you know, the heart of what keeps life kicking on this planet. And also, maybe we're missing out on the heart of what's sacred. So that was the beginning. The name change happened in 2003 to really broaden the sort of action appeal of Quaker Earth Care Witness, make it clear that we're not just kind of trying to say, hey, friends, change your values, but also when there's a planetary crisis, let's do something about it. And I think it's really with that energy in 2023 that I entered the organization. As the first general secretary of my age range, I'm 33 years old. And yeah, it's, I think ever since then, it's just, I think one of the heart pieces of my message, and I think growingly of the organization as a whole, is that we live in prophetic times. That, as our good friend George Lakey often says, I could not imagine a more exciting time to be alive.
That's
And
awesome.
like also in some way, a spiritually more meaningful. I think we really do in a very clear way live in some ways at the end, in some sense, of history as it was. There was a history as it was where humanity could be pretty immature, could we could, fight wars with one another, we could mismanage our local ecosystems, et cetera, and the planet mostly absorbed that, right? That era has ended. The amount of power we've obtained as a species makes that level of immaturity unviable. We will either grow up or we will facilitate the most tragic thing that's happened on this planet for the last 65 million years. And the gravity of that, I think that's one of the things I just want to impress upon friends, that we've only been here as a species for 200,000 years, give or take. It depends on how anthropologists setting their lines, dividing that. But that's how long we've been alive on this planet. The amount of time it took to recover from extinctions like that happened at the end of the Cretaceous or the Permian, et cetera, biodiversity returns to normal levels in about 10 million years, 50 times the amount of time that we've been a species. That's way longer than civilization is, if we want to put quotations on that, we could. But that, we didn't evolve to understand the gravity of that. We didn't, but we're going to have to grow into it. And I think it's actually, that sounds really overwhelming, but it can also be inspiring. It can be really exciting. And I think this is a time for us to be turning back to those sages and voices and teachers that have existed throughout history that have always been pointing the way. But it's time we listened.
Thank you so much, Keith. That's just such an awesome introduction, and you planted so many seeds that I want to try to water and grow a little bit in the conversation. And so there's a few things in there that I hope we can talk about. And so one is connected with Marshall Massey and this wonderful sort of building off of. My understanding is he was building off a little bit of the peace testimony, but also really evolving ideas about stewardship, and thinking deeply about that and moving from stewardship toward kinship, I think is the way that it's phrased. And I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about that. But before we do that, would love it if you would just say a little bit more about your own personal journey, because I think friends are interested in your journey. And particularly something we focus a lot on in our Climate Action Committee is the role of, prophetic witness and how we are called, to do the work we do and how that sits for us spiritually. And just since we have you in this conversation, I would love just to hear your personal journey a little bit, how you got where you are and what the role of spirit is for you in the work that you do.
Yeah, well, yeah, I guess I want to start just by saying I think that there's lessons that we all have in our own story that relate to other people's stories. And I think a lesson from my story that may be available for some listeners is that no matter how much you think you're set on a path, and there's just no way to change what that path is because you didn't set up your career the right way or your life the right way, you're just not position to do it. Your calling is out of reach. I don't want to fully put a, bootstraps narrative or something like that, but I do think that, just to put a little vigor there, that my story was being a neuroscience major. I got a degree in neuroscience, And I was studying all sorts of things. I came out of college, was working in a lab, and I just totally did not fit. I studied neuroscience initially because I had a deep spiritual experience that I was trying to understand. And then I just have a really strong intellectual inclination. And there was this just desire to understand the nature of consciousness, the nature of all of these things. So that's a totally different conversation we could go into. But the calling to serve the earth, I really just, I think moving into my mid-20s, I grew up in a Quaker community, a Quaker school actually, that the John Woolman School, Sierra Friends Center, the Woolman Semester, now closed, and the land has been passed on to the Nisenan tribe. Friends can look up that story. But I grew up on that land and with friends there, and the strong values, the three goals of that education system was educating young people about peace, justice, and sustainable living. So I think there was that strong calling, but then I think I churned towards this kind of like, okay, but I just want to A, revel in and also grasp reality a little better. That's what I spent my late teens, early 20s doing. And then stepping into my early mid 20s, it was like, oh, I'm on the wrong path here. I want to make a difference. And I don't think I'm going to do it in a lab. It's just not right for me. And so I took this weird path first into education, but then like doing activism on the side. And so I was doing education. And I was an outdoor educator at first, and then I ended up becoming a teacher in a classroom. But the so there was that story, and being an outdoor educator, I think certainly was also part of my own evolution. If you're having a hard time in your life, and I just especially, I guess this goes out to young people. There's in California at least, there's these amazing outdoor schools, and I found an incredible community that during this really hard life transition moment for me, where I kind of hit rock bottom, I just felt buoyed by this, spiritual community that was not spiritual, traditional sense. And so that was transformative for me. Yeah, I began a podcast called A Future on Waxen Wings that was all about how humanity is flying too close to the sun, essentially, and our hubris as a civilization. We are destroying all that matters and all that matters to us. And but then I was hanging out at a Quaker meeting, and then they were like, you should join the Unity with Nature Committee. And then I started getting involved in Extinction Rebellion and all of these things, and met this incredible activist who asked me what, beyond my intellectual sense of things, what did I feel called to do? And after sitting with that for 3 days, I went off and I did a 12-day long hunger strike. And I went and traveled from meeting to meeting to talk about the need for action and the need to live in real solidarity, that, like to not allow the suffering to be elsewhere, to be like as fully intimate with it as your body, your soul, your spirit allows you to be. And so that evolved into talks and other things. I was a teacher in Washington, and then eventually I was leading up the Unity of Nature Committee for Pacific Yearling Meeting, and I got really close to some people in Quaker Earthcare Witness, and the last general secretary left, and they said, yeah, he's never been the director of an organization before, but we're going to give him a shot. And that was, a huge shift in my capacity to, I was living kind of two lives, one as an educator and one as an activist. And then it's really become a whole life project.
Thank you
So,
so much for
yeah.
sharing all that. I mean, I think it's so interesting how spirit works in our lives, and it's not always a straight and logical path. And I think always a beautiful thing to hear, how someone experiences that, and following your leadings, and oftentimes the confusing parts of it as well as the parts that make sense. And so it's wonderful just to hear the energy and enthusiasm that you're bringing to all of this work. And so before we do a more deeper dive into some pieces of this, also maybe if you could just tell us a little bit about again, the general mission and vision. I think people probably have some sense of it, but when you're explaining to people, when you meet somebody and you have to tell them in a few sentences what Quaker Earthcare Witness is trying to change in the world, how do you describe that for people?
I mean, I think it really is fundamentally about this reckoning with how we've outstepped our light, right? That's really maybe what we've done as a civilization, and that there's a humbler, simpler, more peaceful way of being on this earth. And it's available to all of us if we're willing to turn towards it. So that's a really, I think in that there's a thousand little shifts in consciousness that I think is really the foundation. I'm a big believer in pragmatism, a big believer in getting things done. But what we all need to realize is that foundationally, there's no way that this ship won't fully right itself until we as a species grow up. So that's step one. But we're doing. I think that the second thing is that we try to live our testimonies in the world, and that has two different roles. I think at one level, it's about pragmatically what do you achieve, right? So, if we're fighting to defend a particular bill, like we fought to defend the Inflation Reduction Act, which is oddly named, but for those who didn't follow, the largest climate bill in history that was passed in 2022. From repeal by the Trump administration. That's a very, practical action. We are also, working with mini grants to support cloud forest restoration in Veracruz, Mexico, to doing work on direct action trainings, et cetera, with Earthquaker Action Team. That's the one side of this is pragmatically what are we trying to achieve, right? But there's also the spirit that we bring to it, right? And I think that it's the union of those things, right? Where we show up at the action, but you can feel the presence of the spirit in the way that we do it, right? Where we're doing mini grants, but there's a sacred way that we're going about this grant making process that's not just transactional. Like there's a foundation in spirituality and then all these forms of action, but roughly, we do work with the United Nations. We're organizing campaigns right now, specifically community organizing efforts that Quaker meetings can apply for. So keep your eyes out for that. But the and then the mini grants program, we're mapping all what Quaker action around the world right now. But the foundation of it is all about shifting that consciousness and the power of this, I these three words have been with me a lot: power, truth, and love, right? And I hope that in any action Quaker Earthcare Witness engages in, the presence of power, truth, and love, is palpable.
Yeah, that's so helpful. And I think that description of the relationship between the practical work that we do, the projects that we work on, and the deeper transformation at the level of spirit and culture that we're trying to drive, how those things are connected is just so important. It's something that we just think about a lot at Radnor too. And I think Quakers are thinking about it too, because, and it also, I think, does tie into the theme of resilience, because there's so much about this moment that it carries a certain futility around it. So you get to the point of like, what difference is this going to make, you know? And but you have to remember that when you gather up millions of futile actions, there's this tipping point that happens, and suddenly they're not futile anymore. And I think we can see that in human affairs. I think I like to think of some of the wins around culture transformation. I often think about people smoking cigarettes, which is not a bad metaphor, because they're burning things. And you think about like the people who set out to try to convince people not to smoke, and how absolutely insane that must have seemed when that started, when you're living on a planet where everybody smokes all the time. And then little by little they chip away at it until suddenly there's a recognition and people go, I got to stop doing this. It's bad for me. And so I'd really like to bring in Lee and Lee, have you help me frame a question which I know you've been thinking about. I feel certain, Keith, that you've been thinking about this question. I think it's a very deep question, and it goes back to that Marshall Massey moment because, and it has to do with, even I remember we were talking about Marshall Massey, and we're talking about the defense of the peaceable kingdom, which is, I think, his original article was called "The Defense of the Peaceable Kingdom," and friends were like, "The kingdom? I don't like the word kingdom." You know what I mean? And it's this thing about how human beings see themselves as connected to the earth. This idea about stewardship, where you're lording over the earth, and then I'll pick out just a word that you said in the introduction about humility. You know, about reframing yourself in your relationship to the earth. Lee, help me with this because I know it's something that you think about a lot, and let's see if we can get you into it, and maybe then we can have Keith answer both of us.
Well, I mean, I think the people who objected to the use of the word kingdom next to peaceable had a very good point. And I mean, if you look at this, there's one thing about the well-intentioned invocation of the peaceable kingdom, but really look at the painting, or the see it's actually a series of paintings. But they all have certain things in common. And let's just take, I mean, there are many things that we could kind of pull apart in that painting, right? But let's just take the little child shall lead them. Let's just start there. So the tiniest member of our species will be the one who leads those who used to be the most powerful, most ferocious, true top of the food chain of you, if there is a food chain. Obviously there's a web of life, right? But if we were thinking about terms of hierarchies and food chains, that little child is not it, right? And so the hubris is right there in the painting. All right. The lion or leopard is not going to lie down with the lamb unless you do some really weird things to that leopard, okay? And I mean, think about that, because I have a friend, Jeffrey Mason, who's a book author of many books and also a psychologist. And we were talking about this domestication, right? Which is the way you take really ferocious, intimidating animals and you turn them into tractable, manageable commodities. And Jeffrey Mason said, I'm just going to take this way out of context, but this is where we got in the conversation. This was the most important sentence of it to me, when Jeffrey said, I'll go even further than what I just said. I'm going to say that our original sin was domestication. This is ringing, this was years ago. And we still talk about this because Jeffrey's in the middle of writing a book right now. Think about that. Gives us an entirely different framework to look at the peaceable kingdom. And it asks us to take apart some of our assumptions of what peace is. And it asks us to thresh out those assumptions and to challenge ourselves to think, well, maybe creating our own order on this earth was not peaceable. And maybe we need to rethink who we are in relationship to all the other living communities on Earth, and that the violent way we have made them into our servants, basically, and our commodities is one thing. And then there's another layer of it, which is the stewardship. And it's when we take control and yet we do it in what we think is a benign way. And then you might say the ideal in a thought experiment, right, would be to let it be, to the extent that, I mean, there's some justice needs to be done, right? Some reparations need to be done. We can just let everybody who's dependent on us run free, right? We need to respect and preserve those who are free living and free of our control. And but that doesn't mean send everybody who's domesticated and dependent out into the wild. So it's complex, but what we're getting to is taking our hands off nature's neck, basically. That's where we're getting to, right? So in this thought experiment, which is kind of like maybe Keith's and I know it's my life experience is my experiment with life and the light as I understand it right now, is how can I rewild myself? How can I live to the extent possible the way nature asked me to live before we did all this controlling and this commodifying? Who were we as a species? Who am I? We look at our ancestry. Well, let's look at our ancestry in terms of Earth ancestry and ask, who are we if we really live in peaceful, true peaceful coexistence with the other living communities on this earth? Who are we? And I think, that is the thought experiment of a lifetime.
I'm happy to jump in.
Yeah,
I
please.
just I love that. And I feel like we've been able to do a little bit of we've in public containers, we've often been rather scripted. I just love being off script a little bit and being able to jam here. But yeah, I think the Janes, friends may or not may or may not be familiar with Jainism in another kind of parallel sister tradition to Buddhism in India. And in Jainism, there's this 2,500 year old tradition of basically trying to be so attentive to ahimsa, non-killing, non-harm, that you don't even kill insects. So, Jain monks will sweep the ground in front of them to avoid stepping on things. And so, and what I think is beautiful in what you've just laid out, and what I want to center is reverence, the word reverence. And for me, it's about seeing the world as it is. And rather than jumping to imposing your sense, your very narrow and limited human sense of what the solution is to X problem that you perceive, it's taking the time to really observe it as it is and fall in love with it, and then from this, and to only make choices that would change anything from a place of deep respect, deep reverence, deep attunement to what is. And I think that that's the opposite, really, of the colonial imperial ethic that has so taken over our world in the striving for power. But yeah, so much more I could say about this, but I think that that at the very heart of a kinship worldview is that sense, right, of reverence for all else that exists. And something we should point out, Lee kind of mentioned this about rethinking or re-understanding the peace testimony. The peace testimony doesn't make sense if we're looking for the peaceable kingdom, as in the lion doesn't eat the lamb, right? Or that might not be ecological sense, but the pronghorn or something, or I'm messing this up on the you guys, antelope, but the lion, is going to eat the antelope, right? But do all interactions of that sort need to be non-sacred? I think it's a question that we need to think about. And we're always, your body is in the process of killing thousands of living beings as we speak, right? That's what your immune system does, right? When you take life, whenever you eat, you take life in some way. How does every, we speak about in the Friends tradition, that we don't have ritual because every moment is a sacrament or a ceremony, right? That all of life is sacraments, so we don't do sacraments. But how many friends are actually practicing sacrament in everyday life? How many friends move through the world as if it was a sacrament? I think that we could probably do a little bit more sacrament just to actually get practiced at it. It'd be a small suggestion on my part. I think that once again, it's this deep internal shift, and I think it relates to the sense of futility that you were mentioning earlier, David. When Lee started this, and you began there, I just want to name that we're also not here for our own lives only. We're not just here for our children's lives. We're not just here for what's right in front of us. You, I, David, Lee, myself, we're 13.7 billion years old, 13.7, 13.8. The beingness that has resulted in my being began at least 13.8 billion years ago, in accordance with the best knowledge that we know of as science. And we need to start acting our age. And so, that also means that we have this, that you're part of a continuance. And that your role, even if you think, we're all screwed here, American democracy is failing. There's reasonable things to think American democracy is failing, that climate change is getting worse and worse, and governments are doing far too little to do anything about it, that the AI stuff is profoundly scary. We could talk about that more. But I want to name that I think there's a power, and friends have named this over and over and over again. People of faith have named this over and over again through history, that love outlasts hate, that violence carries the seeds of its own destruction, that foolishness defeats itself, right? And that even though it can destroy, I mean, you can have a 10 million year long impact of violence and foolishness, but it is self-defeating. And what you and I and everyone here listening to this call are doing is we're playing our note for this moment, and then we're passing it on to the next person. And what our role is to be a part of that great flow of life and a great steward of that flow of life. Do we get to control how it plays out this time? No, but does love win in the end? I'm actually going to make the radical case that it always does.
So much in what you just said. And I think of the concept of long-termism, which sees us connected to people that come long, long after. I think of it's interesting that you referenced going to a school with the name Woolman, because Woolman is a great philosopher of these things. I mean, the whole idea of seeing the connection among the choices that we make in our own lives and how they impact everything else. I think he has some great stuff about seeing in your own possessions the seeds of war and the seeds of slavery. So the deep connection between the personal and the system as a whole. But what I really love about what you both were saying too is in this vision of humility and reframing perhaps the relationship between individuals and the earth from one of kingship or stewardship to one of kinship and equality. We try to capture it in this word ecological integrity, which is this idea of the wholeness and being part of the whole, which I hear in what you said about seeing your own being connected to the dawn of time and seeing your being reflected in all the beings around you. That is such a rich vision. And I think about one of the things we've thought about a lot, and I'd love to let you talk a little bit about this, Keith, is that effort to try to wake, to have people to become spiritually awake about that, and something that a dear friend of mine said that I've often mentioned in worship at Radnor is when you're feeling very pessimistic and shattered and despondent about the state of the world, recognize that that is only because you are spiritually awake. So, in that sense, it is a gift to see the injustice. Like it is the spirit manifesting, within you. To be able to see that. So cherish that you're alive and that you're not asleep through this. So the question that I want to ask you is like, What is it that we do as friends to try to help people become more awake, and how do we stay on that path of becoming more awake ourselves? Because oftentimes it's like the thing you learn today, you wish you had learned 10 years ago. So it's like we are all learning all the time. But talk about that, because I know you are at the front lines of that work everywhere you go.
I'm going to plagiarize a bit. Some friends may be familiar with the book Zen and the Art of Saving the Planet, one of the last ones written by Thich Nhat Hanh Thai and Sister Trudha Akeshan, who has been both of whom have been significant influences on me. But they begin their book in the most beautiful way. What they say, first of all, is, and they take this concept of awakening in Buddhism, which I think there's so much that's been said about it that sometimes we lose like a human sense of what that means. It just like it's held off as such a lofty ideal, right? So let's break it down. First of all, awakening is awakening to beauty. It's awakening to the fact that, we're here at all, that, we can breathe in and breathe out, and billions of mitochondrial motors are feeling the vitality of our bodies. You can feel the tingle that moves down your spine as you think of that. You can think about the beauty as you look outside your window and the sunlight is streaming through these leaves filled with chlorophyll and sunlight that's, breathing this planet into life that you're in communion with in this vast and mysterious universe that we all live in. It's an extraordinary thing that we're here, right? And the more we become sensitive to how deep that beauty goes, to how present it is in the smallest of things, the humblest of things, the more awake we become. And so that's the first side. And the second side is very Buddhist, which is that we awaken to suffering. We awaken to the immensity of suffering. We awaken to crass and cruelty and how far some of us have fallen, and we experience it. To experience it in the same way as if, when you see the harm that's done, as if a close loved one was doing those harms. Someone you had fallen, you had deeply communed with, had fallen that far. I think it's that way that we need to be connecting to this, because it's a profound, profound suffering. And they finish, Sister Trudha Akeshan and Thay finish by saying, so you see that first thing, how beautiful it all is, how tender it all is, how extraordinary it all is. You see the second thing and how that beauty and that tenderness and that extraordinariness is being harmed. And if at the end of that, you're not feeling a profound need to transform every aspect of your life, you haven't experienced, it's no fault of yours. It's not like there's something defective about you. You just need to wake up more. You need to like really open your eyes and say, oh my God, like you've had that experience at some point in your life. Go back there, right? Like when you really knew how beautiful it all was. And then when you really touched in with the tragedy, touch in with that. And if you're able to get that tender, you will transform your life, right? That's awakening. And it's from there that reverence, responsibility, ecological growth, resilience, all of these things come from that profound transformation that moves through our lives. And, that's a reflection of the Buddhist tradition. We also have a rich tradition amongst friends, but it all starts, how do you realize the beauty? You slow down and you get still and you see with new eyes, you see it for the first time. So, all of these stories are connected, but I guess that's what I would say about awakening.
Such a wonderful message. And I think this is kind of like a perfect segue to talk a little bit about the work that Lee has been doing with you on Experiment with the Light with Quaker Earthcare Witness. And so maybe I could ask you both to speak to this question, and a little bit about what it, because I want to tell our listeners that, Experiment with the Light is a way, perhaps a practice that would be a door opening to becoming more awake in this regard. And And there is an opportunity, an ongoing opportunity to be with friends who are working on this together in a spirit of community. And so I'd love for you to tell us, and I'll like to ask both of you to speak to this. What is Experiment with the Light? What is it about? It sounds very mysterious if you never heard it before. What is it? And although it's incredibly cool, I think it's Rex Ambler. You know, we'll talk a little bit about Rex Ambler's work, but also how are you beautifully using it to think about these so important issues in you know, earth care?
Lee, why don't you lead us off? Yeah.
Yeah,
Go ahead.
go, Keith, go. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I guess. So first of all, we had this initial program at Friends General Conference. We had like eight folks there or something like that. It was this little group of people where we went through. I think everyone here listening to the podcast should be familiar with the Emerge booklet and the Emerge Values framework that's come out of Radnor Friends Meeting. But Lee really took us on this adventure to sink into the deeper meaning behind each of these words, right? Relationship, emergence, mindfulness, this new, you know, this new set of values, not to replace the spices, but to complement them, for friends to deepen into in our lives. And what we ended up doing last fall was we ended up saying, this is great, but what if, you know, each of these is its own journey and its own step? And so what we did, you know, I was talking to Lee, and Lee had this fantastic idea of bringing in the Experiments with Light framework, started by Rex Ambler, to, you know, basically bring that into the way in which we were doing our practice. Each, you know, once a month, we're going into each of these stories. And in essence, the Experiments with Light practice, I might let Lee kind of explain it in detail, because I think Lee has more experience than I do. But it leads us through this journey of first witnessing and then seeing what comes out of that witness, reckoning with what that witness is asking us to do, which often, you know, it's, you know, in modern Quakerism, we often want to make everything kind of feel fluffy. I think that's like the liberalism of our culture, that commodification of things has really made things more superficial. Early friends were like, this light is exposing you, you know, like this light is showing you your sh and you need to like really see it. So it's the light of conscience. And I'll let Lee kind of fill us, you know, fill that out a bit more.
Oh, that's right. The early Quakers did understand the light as showing us our darkness and strengthening ourselves to change our lives. And there is a kind of a, I'll call it maybe a paradox. Let me call it a paradox. When you do experiment with light, this is modeled after, as Rex Ambler, this historian, and theologian read. Fortunately, Quakers had a lot of notes. He kept notes back in the day, you know, so you can find these 17th century notes about meetings, and including George Fox, you know. So George Fox comes in and actually comes into the guided meditation. You do hear things that George Fox literally, you know, was saying back in the early days of Quakerism. And the question is, what did they do? What was it that strengthened them when they lived in a time when they were forced to migrate, when they were put into prison, when they were tortured? What is it? Why are we Quakers today? Why weren't they just annihilated by those huge forces against them? You know, like today we could look at Minneapolis, right, and say, oh, why wasn't that city just totally in cowering, right, in the face of the authority? Well, we could ask the same thing. But they found, the early Quakers found within the light, as they gathered together, this kind of strength. And the paradox is this: when they're together, and we kind of replicate this by going into small groups in the breakout room, We start after the meditation, the guided meditation, we start to talk about what we have found during the meditation, in the words of the early Quakers. What did that bring to us? And as we do this, no one says, makes any judgments, expresses any opinions. Everyone listens. Now, you can make gestures, you can, your facial expressions, that's all right, but no comments. And this is like sacrosanct, no comments. There's actually something called double confidentiality. So that if you see somebody like later on in a shop and they you know them from the group or the light group, and they said something, even if they said, don't even bring up to them what they said unless they bring it up. All right. And what this does is, as I understand from people who have shown me this practice, is that you don't want to interrupt the light working through anyone. So if you were to express advice, care, even in a most caring way, you're interrupting how the light is working with that person. And if you don't do that, and if you abide by this practice, something happens. It starts to happen in weeks. You really feel it in months. And if you talk to somebody who's been doing this years and years and years, they're going to tell you how important this is in their lives. And they're going to use the word change. Now, here's the paradox. And I want to go back to something that Keith said about Thai ancestor true dedication, because I think it's helping me with this. And by the way, Keith actually introduced me through a Quaker Earth Care Witness workshop to Sister True Dedication. So I heard all this at Quaker Earth Care Witness. It's beautiful. And for you to replay it here is just as beautiful. And it's talking to this paradox. Now, here it is. We don't want to interrupt the light that's working through one another. And yet, we don't want to, David, you said we don't want to learn something 10 years later that we could have learned now. And we're right now dealing with the fierce urgency of now. I think that was MLK, the fierce urgency of now. And to delay justice is to deny it, right? And what happens to a dream deferred, right? And what happens to this atmosphere if we defer change? You see where the paradox is coming in now. How do you inspire and yet deal with time? And so something that Keith said now in that revisiting that, you're helping me. Do you know where I'm going? Because if you do you see where I'm where Thai ancestor true dedication, where they spoke, first you are understanding the truth about your
That's exactly
role
right.
in the world, right? Then, and you are understanding after you know how beautiful it is. And then the question is, if you really know that, you will be inspired. If you're really in the light, you will know what to do. And those words are in Experiment with Light. You will know what to do.
That's so powerful, Lee. That's so powerful. I have a little bit of Fox's letter. This is his Epistle 10, and I just want to read this. Stand still in that which shows and discovered, and there doth strength immediately come. Stand still in the light and submit to it, and the other will be hushed and gone, and then content comes. And when temptations and troubles appear, sink down in that which is pure, and all will be hushed and fly away. Your strength is to stand still.
Grace comes in the light.
Yeah, that's awesome. It's really awesome. And I just invite friends to, because you can talk about this, but I think to really experience it is very powerful. And it reminds me also of something that C.S. Lewis said, which I love in the book Miracles. He said, God is not a bowl of tapioca pudding. It is when you hear the voice of the spirit, it may not be comforting to you. So, yeah, I think that we can invite friends to perhaps join one of these sessions and really experience that. Because if you're drawn to Quaker worship, this is a slightly different form of it, but it is very powerful.
What one thing, yeah.
Go ahead.
I just want to drop in there that I think it's an often stated thing in Pacific Yearly Meeting, and I don't want to speak for Philadelphia Yearly Meeting or any other yearly meeting, but I think, and this might be worse on the West Coast than it is on the East Coast, just because of the connections to tradition, but I think there are a decent number of friends who have lamented to me on many an occasion that we're all sitting here and meeting for worship, but like, are in any sense, are we all doing the same thing here? Do we all have any agreement as to what it is that's being practiced in this moment, right? Quakers leaned really hard in the direction early on of basically a anti-monasticism, right? Where there's, you know, the system, you know, Buddhism is like the most systematized. It's like kind of maybe too systematized, right? Where it kind of every, you know, there's all these stages and steps, et cetera, like that it becomes a whole process. But I think Quakers leaned on this side of basically giving no, you know, not at least in terms of like explicit, like you don't get these monastic manuals on like how you do it. And I think what the attempt was is to say there's something really radical that moved through this religious movement that was born in the 1650s. What was it, right? And maybe it was something organic at that time. There was, I think, a lot of training of, you know, friends were this very tight-knit community for so long. You know, from one generation to the next, of you can read it in Woolman's journals when he speaks about, you know, his own experience of the light. He often speaks about being, you know, under the weight of things and being tested by, and we don't speak that way enough today. I think that we need to bring back some of that language, that when you notice in yourself that some part of you isn't right with something, that's your conscience speaking to you, right? And early friends would have said, let's really attend to that weight, right? That's telling you maybe you shouldn't have slaves. Maybe you shouldn't have money in the stock market. Maybe you shouldn't be, you know, buying meat from the, you know, this industry that's, this, you know, the factory farming industry and taking life in this way. You know, whatever it is, I think that those things weigh on us. But to name that has always, I think it from one generation to the next in early Quakerism, it was taught that you sunk into the stillness to feel the weight of that, of the light pressing on you and showing you these things. And we've lost that sort of seriousness as a tradition, and we need to bring it back. And it's what drove so many friends for so long to radically transform their lives in a way that, frankly, compared to like now, like, friends were way more radical relative to their own society in 1650 than we are relative to our society in 2026, right? So we can do better. And then and it's and the what it's not even the us that's doing it, it's the light that will work through us. But first we have to open ourselves to it. And I think
Amen.
showing up to it, one of these experiments with light trainings would be, you know, that
A great way
these
to
practices
start.
are great.
Yeah. And it's just like the idea of, I think, just to tie it back to the idea of witness, you know, which is it's Quaker Earth Care witness. And the witness is, you know, what comes out of the light. You know, the witness is the prophetic witness of, you know, feeling the voice of the spirit with great specificity about what is required now, you know, and not just, it's not necessarily here to make you feel better or wonderful, but
And it
also,
can. I think we should
yeah,
name it can do that too.
it
It's
can
not
do
all
that too.
darkness.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I often think too that I really have come, and I think this is a wonderful thing about Radnor Meeting and any meeting that's functioning well, is that you see, and I'm sure that you're trying to build this in the community of Quaker Earth Care Witness, that it is the community of friends and the friendships, the relationships. You know, another Fox expression is the idea of being written in one another's hearts, you know, and the idea that the truth is something that we can know through our relationships with each other, you know, deeply. And it is the community that gives us the chance to witness that kind of inner truth, which is what we are called to do, you know. So I'm just so thankful, for your work, Keith. And I want to be respectful of your time, friend, because I know we're taking up your Sunday afternoon. And so I do want to bring our conversation to a close, but I want to give you a chance also just to say a couple things. What can friends do to help Quaker Earthcare Witness? And what can they do if there's a few things that you would recommend to friends as they begin their journey, of caring better for the earth? Maybe we have some people listening who are just starting. What would be the first steps that you would advocate for them? And of course, we're going to urge everybody to support Quaker Earth Care Witness because we need support for it. But in terms of their choices in their homes, in their communities, and publicly, where can they begin? That's my
Yeah,
question.
wait one second, because Keith has got to have the last word. So I want to just throw in something really quick before Keith. So
That's
Keith,
good.
you can cogitate that on that for on one more minute, because there was something in the conversation that you both were saying, but it's not all darkness. There's something that's really good there when you do this. And what that brings up is, I don't know if this is a fair analogy, but it seems that way. It feels that way to me, that addiction, right? Because I have struggled with addictions. And I think addiction feels like thinking that something that is bad for us is good. We want it. It's desirable. It's not. It's bad for us. And so what's recovery? It's leaning in to what's good for us and realizing that it feels good to want what protects us, to want what truly nourishes us. And so I think we could do an analogy, maybe. I know addiction analogies are touchy, but I feel this, that when we're recovering from being this consumer, competitive person that is just totally what the capitalist system wants of us, right? But when we step back and read from the light, what's expected of us as a species living amongst other species, right? What can we do that would feel good for the earth? And can we come as we start to present ourselves every day a little bit more, a little bit stronger, at this as we strive to live in cooperation and communion with our earth, then these steps we take towards simplicity, towards really ecological integrity, start to feel good. All of a sudden, they don't feel like you're giving something up or depriving yourself of something. All of a sudden, you think, hey, I was a real ape today. I mean, that felt good.
I want to echo that, and I've also struggled with addiction in some ways, and recovery sucks, right? It does, and so does recovery sucks. Starting to exercise when you don't exercise sucks. Eating healthy food when you haven't been eating healthy food starts. It sucks at first, but anyone who knows, who's ever gone just a little bit on that journey knows that on the other side of that is a sense of well-being that, frankly, we just don't know until we've stepped on over to the other side. And there's things that you thought were satisfying before you took those steps that just, pale in comparison. And I think what we're missing is the full vitality of life. Those that your conscience loves you and it doesn't want you to wound your soul. It wants you to be a fully integrated human, a powerful human, a human that's in their power, in love, in life, for whom life radiates off of them, And you get there not by taking shortcuts, but by going the whole way. And so we obviously need to be there for one another. in those journeys. It's great to have a companion and just reach out for those sorts of connections. So I guess, moving into things to recommend, don't do it alone, do it together. Cultivate radical hope. If you are suffering from a malaise, so common and so easy in this time, remember that the deepest things will outlast this, right? And that you're here, Jesus talks about faith like a mustard seed. Faith as small as a mustard seed can move mountains. And I just want to encourage friends to find that mustard seed in themselves, because it doesn't have to start large. It can start out very small. And from that place, there's tons of ways for us to, I really want to encourage people to act locally and globally to, feed your communities, feed yourself, do feed your soul, and then also feed the world, and I think Quaker Earth Care Witness has got a pretty bold, one of the things we've approved in our new language that describes who we are as an organization is we're trying to be as bold as our times are urgent. So if that notion appeals to you, and if you would like to campaign to win real change in the next few years for the Earth, and that appeals to your soul on its journey, part of this 13.8 billion year journey that we've been speaking about, and you want to spend some of your time here on Earth helping us make that difference, we'd be happy to have you. So go to quickearthcare.org is my shameless plug for the end of that. But yeah, we'd love to have you.
Thank you so much for giving us some time, Keith, and we hope you'll come back again. And we look forward to continuing this conversation with you and the work together. It's been wonderful to spend a few minutes with you this afternoon.
Yeah, same with you guys. And if you can make it to the next Emerge event, you can also look for that quakerearthcare.org/events, and you can be with Lee, probably David, and myself.
Excellent. We'll put all that in the show notes.